Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sfarim Chatter podcast. For this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Professor Neil Nathanel, who holds the Pete Cameron Endowed Chair in Law at UCLA, where he writes and teaches in the areas of copyright, trademark, and international intellectual property. He's also the author of a number of books, but the book that we'll be discussing today is From Maimonides to Microsoft, The Jewish Law of Copyright Since the Birth of Print, from Oxford University Press. And we'll obviously be discussing the Jewish copyright and what that means and its development. So thank you very much, Professor Nathanel, for joining me.
It's really a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So let's start off with, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background.
All right. Well, I'm a professor of copyright law. As you mentioned, my wife and I live more or less half the year in Israel and half in Los Angeles. We've now been in Israel since December of 2019 as a result of a sabbatical plus the COVID pandemic. And I did not grow up in the yeshiva world. When I began the project, I thought, well, I speak fluent Hebrew. I read fluent Hebrew. I can read Israeli legal materials. I practice law in Israel. So I thought, you know, it's certainly something that I could handle. And as I delved into it, of course, I found it, you know, very challenging. And it was really a labor of love for several years.
So, I mean, that really draws the question is that, like you said, you didn't grow up in the yeshiva world. So why is this a topic? And obviously you are a copyright scholar, but why did you decide, okay, I'm going to write something on the Jewish angle. I'm going to discuss the halachic angle. Why was that something that you decided to research and write on?
Yes. Well, my wife and I were married in Yerushalayim. And before we were married, we met with a rabbi who officiated at our wedding. Lovely man. And he just asked us, you know, asked me what I'm interested in. And I, you know, at that time I was practicing law in Israel and mentioned I'm interested in copyright law. And he lent me a manuscript. At that time it was a manuscript of the Israeli Ministry of Justice, which was a compilation of rabbinic reprinting bans, the Haskamot, and told me, I didn't know there was such a thing as Jewish copyright law until that moment, and told me about it. And from that time on, I was really fascinated with the topic and decided that one day I wanted to delve into it and write about it.
Okay, so I think actually, interestingly, I think we should start off on the other side. I think we should start off with a little bit to briefly describe, brief overview, not for the layman, so to speak, an overview of American/general copyright law. I know they're different with American, European, just general copyright law, what that is and how it developed, and then we'll compare it and we'll dive into the halachic and the Jewish angle.
Yeah, very basically, copyright gives a set of rights to an author of a work. So copyright celebrates creative expression, right? And any author who creates creative expression has exclusive rights in the author's work, including the right to make copies. If I write a novel, no one else can copy my novel without my permission. No one else can make a movie based on my novel without my permission. No one else could perform a novel on stage if they wanted to read it without my permission and the like. So I have a set of exclusive kind of property rights, one might say, in my creative expression. The first modern copyright statute was in the early 18th century. So it was about 200 years after the advent of print. And that's really part of our story, right? Before there was the modern copyright statute, again, modern copyright, this is true in the United States as well as in Europe, recognizes rights of authors, of creators in their work. Even though authors very often assign their copyright to their publisher. I mean, Oxford University Press owns their copyright in my book. I don't. But I'm the author still, right? And in the first instance, I own the copyright, right? And there's sort of an ideology, I would say, surrounding copyright of celebrating creative expression, right, and authorship. But before the first modern copyright statute, books were protected by a whole system of what were called book privileges. So with the advent of print, publishers of books, and very often the publishers would publish books that were old books that had been written centuries before, but were not in print. And it was an incredibly expensive and risky investment for a publisher to come out with a new edition of a book. And they began to this is, again, soon after the advent of print, they would petition the local ruler or the Pope or the monarch for an exclusive right to print their book. So prohibiting anyone else from printing that book for a certain number of years. So that was a whole system of book privileges that existed in Europe, until the Enlightenment, basically, until the early 1700s, when it began to be replaced by modern copyright statutes as we know them today.
Okay, so like you already mentioned, that it started with books, and that's really where the whole copyright story started. So let's start off, I guess, with the Jewish copyright law. How that developed, and when do we see it first arising? When did this first start?
Yeah, so Jewish texts began to be published in books at roughly the same time as non-Jewish texts, the early 1500s. And just like with non-Jewish books, it could be a very expensive, risky proposition to invest in the publication of a book. So the Jewish copyright law, the first record we have of it was someone named Eliyahu Bachur published three books of Hebrew grammar in 1518. And he petitioned he got an exclusive publishing a book privilege from the Pope to begin with. Because he was concerned that non-Jews might also reprint his book and thereby undercut his investment. But that wasn't enough for him. And then the Pope's printing privilege forbade any Catholic and Christian from printing the book under pain of excommunication anywhere in the Catholic world. But he also wanted a reprinting ban from rabbis, that was enforceable against Jews. So he petitioned the Rome Rabbinic Court for a reprinting ban, an exclusive right to print his book for 10 years.
Now, where did that number come from, 10 years? Was that just picked out of a hat?
That's a good, a very good question. It might have been picked out of a hat, but not by the Rome rabbis, right? So, it's a theme of my book that, and I think this is really something fascinating about the study of the Jewish law of copyright, there are many facets of the Jewish law of copyright that draw deeply upon halachic precedent. Of course, the rabbis drew upon Jewish tradition and Jewish law, but at a number of junctures, they also were aware of and borrowed from the non-Jewish law that surrounded them. So by the time that the Rome Rabbinic Court issued this reprinting ban for Eliyahu Bachur, they were familiar with the book privileges issued by the Pope, the papal authorities at the time, and also other secular authorities. And for various reasons around that time, it was largely standard that these reprinting bans would last for 10 years. The idea being that 10 years would be sufficient time for the publisher to sell out the first edition of the book. And that was really the point, right? To guarantee the publisher the ability to sell out the first print run and thereby recover the publisher's investment. So 10 years was seen more or less as the period of time that was needed for that. That was true in the non-Jewish world, and the rabbinic court in Rome adopted that as the period of exclusivity for Eliyahu Bachur also.
So you mentioned a couple of times where they alluded to book privileges and book reprinting bans, which is something that was obviously in the larger European world at the time. So maybe just talk a little bit briefly about how that developed and what that means exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So, again, I think it's important to understand the economics of this. When before the age of print, books were hand copied by scribes, right? These texts, handwritten manuscripts. And in that era, there was no need for what we now call copyright or exclusive privileges, right? It was only with the advent of print that publishers invested a lot of money in this risky enterprise of printing books, and faced, among other dangers, other risks, they faced the risk that someone else could come in and reprint the book, thereby undercutting the publisher's investment. So publishers began to, and I would say local authorities, like, for example, the Venice Senate, local principalities in what's now Germany, they wanted to attract printers to their realm, and they wanted to encourage the production of useful books. So they began to issue, basically a publisher who wanted a book privilege, who wanted exclusive right, had to petition the local ruler for that privilege. So unlike modern copyright law. Modern copyright law is available automatically. You know, it's a across-the-board statute for any author who creates a book. An author doesn't have to request a copyright. The author just has a copyright by virtue of creating a book. That was not true back then. A publisher had to petition the local ruler for basically a monopoly privilege to print a particular title. And the local rulers typically did that for a limited number of years. The standard became around 10 years.
So let's go back to Leo Bacher or Elijah Levita, as he's known also. Yes. And before we move on to Venice, which would be the next stop, but in Rome at that point, where I think there was only actually these few books, there wasn't many Hebrew books at all printed there. But the so what was the main reasoning and what were some of the highlights in that first reprinting ban, so to speak, from the Rome rabbis that they issued?
Yeah, it's really fascinating because the Rome rabbis, as I said earlier, they heavily borrowed from the printing privileges that were already in existence in the non-Jewish world. But of course, there had been a court, right? And they need to base this granting of a exclusive right to Eliyahu Bachor to print his book. They have to ground it in halakha. So they need to look at the halakhic sources for this. The basic halakhic principle that they look at is hasagat gvul, right? It's necessary to protect Bachor's livelihood, right? He and his publishers, right? They've invested money and time in creating this book. If someone can come along and just reprint it and compete with them in the market, their investment will be lost, right? So their livelihood will be harmed. So it's fundamentally a right that sounds in wrongful competition, right? Protecting hasagat gvul, right? Protecting someone's livelihood from incursion by a reprinter. So there are a number of problems with that, interesting halakhic problems with that. So the whole concept of hasagat gvul developed in local communities, right? So someone, the classic example is the alleyway. You know, someone sets up a shop on an alleyway, someone else wants to come along and open up a shop next to them. Does the first person who sits at the shop, do they have a right to prevent the second comer from coming in? So to the extent they do, it's all based on a local geography within the same neighborhood, within the same town. But books present an entirely different problem. The market for books, even at that time, crossed national borders, right? A printer who wanted to recover the investment in a print run of books needed to sell those books to the Jewish world, outside of Rome. Certainly, Bachor wanted to sell to Venice, which was a center of Jewish population. He might have wanted to sell to Jewish locations outside of Italy also, right? So the Rome rabbis fashioned an exclusive right for him that applied not only in Rome, but everywhere in the world. Right? They said, well, books travel from across the seas. Anyone who reprints this book, right, anywhere in the Jewish world is taking Bachor's livelihood, and they're forbidden to do that. So that was controversial at the time, right? Firstly, rabbis traditionally did not have the authority to control the conduct of Jews who were outside their local jurisdiction, right? The rabbinic power was localized. I will add, I didn't say earlier, but I will add that, how would the rabbinic order be enforced? By pain of cherem, right? So they're saying, first of all, no Jew can reprint the book without Bachor's permission or the permission of his publishers. And they also said that no Jew could buy a reprinted book under pain of cherem, right? So that would be quite controversial, extending the rabbinic power to order cherem to Jews who didn't live in Rome, also interpreting the right against hasagat gvul, not only to commercial conduct within Rome, but to commercial conduct printing books everywhere in the world.
Like we said, that's very interesting. And the book, it goes in depth. It reprints the entire, you have it in the actually facsimile of the reprinting ban there, and it's translated and you have notes on it, etc. So that's all in the book. So let's move a little bit north of Rome. We'll to Venice, somewhat in Venice. We'll get to Venice, obviously, more shortly with the main, the first big controversy over this. But before that, obviously, you had Daniel Bomberg, who printed the first complete Shas, and you had Gershom Sansino as well. So between them, there weren't really any bans, right? We don't really get to the next ban till around like 1550. So, I mean, you discuss this in the book a little bit. Why were there no other bans really between them and otherwise?
Right. So, following Eliyahu Bachur, first of all, let me say that the bans were only worth getting for very expensive books, right? There might have been lots of books that were cheap to print and there was no need to get a ban for them. But we're talking substantial investment in, you know, editions of the Talmud, the Mishnah Torah, things like that, right? So that would be the subject of bans. So following Eliyahu Bachur, and even during his time, right, there were three major publishers, successive publishers of Jewish books. And at that time, the center for printing was in Venice, and that was also true with Jewish printing, right, in the first half of the 16th century, right, or at least in Italy, right? So Gershom Sansino, in the first part of the 16th century, was the major publisher of Jewish books. He didn't have any competitors, right? So he would not have had a need for a reprinting ban for his, you know, editions of the Talmud and the like. At one point, though, he did have a competitor, which was someone named Daniel Bomberg. So Bomberg in 1515 was given the exclusive right by the Venice Senate to publish Hebrew books in the Republic of Venice. Bomberg was not Jewish, and that's a very important point here that begins during this time and is a recurrent theme throughout the history of the Jewish book and also Jewish copyright law, which is that in many locations and for various times, Jews were not permitted to print books. And even when they could, they faced competition from non-Jewish publishers, right, who were printing Hebrew books, right, in many cases. So Bomberg was a non-Jew who was given the exclusive right to print Hebrew books by the Venice Senate. At some point, he did overlap with Gershom Sansino, and maybe Sansino, and he also, there's evidence that he also copied, he plagiarized some of Sansino's editions of the Talmud, for example. So Sansino would have had an incentive to try to get a rabbinic ban, right, preventing that activity. He was harmed by that. But it would have been very unlikely that he would have been able to get such a reprinting ban from the rabbis, because Bomberg, you know, he produced editions of the Talmud and other basic Jewish texts that were relied upon by Jewish communities that were studied in the yeshivot in Poland. And Bomberg staunchly resisted, and famously resisted demands by the papal authorities to include Christian apologetics in his editions of the Talmud, right? So they insisted that he, you know, as a condition to him having this exclusive right to print foundational Jewish texts, he had to include in the texts statements by Jewish heretics, basically, explaining, you know, what was wrong with them, right? How various parts of those texts were critical of the church and how, you know, those are terrible, right? Those are bad things. Well, Bomberg staunchly resisted that. He didn't do that, right? There was a history of centuries in which popes had forbidden the printing of the Talmud. And here, all of a sudden, in the early 16th century, the Pope also the authorities in Venice are giving their imprimatur to the printing of the Talmud by this Christian who is resisting their entreaties to include Christian apologetics in his editions. So the rabbis would have looked pretty favorably on having Bomberg. They would not want to have done anything that would have possibly endangered the continued printing of the Talmud and other foundational texts by Bomberg. It would have taken a while, right? And then Bomberg was followed by someone named Giustiani in the mid 16th century, who also had a monopoly on the publication of Jewish books for a long time. So there would not have been any need for any of them to apply for rabbinic printing privileges. And anyway, Bomberg and Giustiani were not Jews, so it probably would have been unlucky for them to want to get a privilege from a reprinting ban from the rabbis.
I mean, let's go there. You mentioned Giustiani already, so let's talk about him. And that really was the one of the foundational aspects here of copyright law, which is the Maram of Padua, Meir Katzenelnbogen of Padua, and his new edition of Mishnah Torah of the Rambam. And I think let's start off, set the stage. You know, who was the mayor Castanello around Padua, and you know, what was the background, what happened before we get to the famous responsa shalos tshuvas of the tshuva of the Rama or Moshe Isserle. So let's start from the beginning, and we'll up till he asked the response.
All right. So the Amaram of Padua was at that time a very esteemed rabbi of Padua, Ashkenazi authority throughout, you know, much of the Ashkenazi world at the time. And he decided to come out with a new edition of the Mishneh Torah. Now, the Mishneh Torah had been printed previously by Bomber, right? But the Maram decided about 30 years earlier. But the Maram decided since 1550 that he wanted to come out with his own print edition. And as I said, at that time, Jews were not allowed to print books. So the Maram probably negotiated with Giustiniani. Giustiniani at that time had a de facto monopoly over Hebrew printing mass. By that time, Bomberg had already left the scene. But the two of them couldn't come to terms. So the Maram came to an agreement with a new upstart Venetian patrician named Alviz Bragadini. Bragadini also wasn't Jewish, right? But basically, the Maram apparently financed the publication of this edition of the Mishneh Torah, and Bragadini was the publisher. So they came out with their edition in 1550. And at the time, it's important to say a lot of the work and the value of these early books had to do with the work of the editor, or they were sometimes called the corrector. Because I'll take the example of the Mishneh Torah, right? So for centuries, right, after the Rambam, right, wrote the Mishneh Torah, it was copied by hand, right, by various foreign. And as a result, there are, just like any manuscript that was copied by hand, there were different variants. Errors would be introduced, or just different versions of those manuscripts. Even the Rambam himself apparently made some changes, and there were different versions, slightly different versions of his manuscript, even during his lifetime. So much of the job and much of the value of these early print editions was the role of the editor or the corrector in reviewing various manuscript versions and deciding what's the correct version, right? What's the authentic version that should be printed? So when the Maram of Padua did this, he had a number of manuscript versions before him. He also had Bomberg's print edition, and he reviewed those. He corrected them. He also added a little bit of his own commentary, but he also chose some additional commentaries to add. So that was a lot of the value of his work.
So obviously, Giustiniani decided to publish in retaliation his own and sell it for a gold coin less, right? And at that point, undercutting him, and he even included Maram Padua's comments in there, and he disparages them. You can talk about that if you want. So at that point, Maram Padua sees he's gonna lose money. So he decides he shouldn't take action, and he writes to the young at that point, Ramesh Isserles, the Ramah in Poland. So first of all, why did he write to the Ramah in Poland, not to an Italian authority? And then talk about what the Ramah ruled and what happened after that.
Right. Okay. So he writes to the Ramah for a ruling or a tshuva, basically, stating that no Jew should buy this competing edition, right? Until he sells out his edition. Of course, the Ramah became one of the giants of the Ashkenazi world, of all, the entire world of Jewry, right? But that time, he was still a young rabbi. He was he had just been recently appointed as the rabbi of Krakow. This apparently was his first tshuva that he ever issued. So there were a number of reasons why the Maram turned to the Ramah. Primarily, I think, was that by that time, Poland was, the yeshivot of Poland were probably the principal market for this book. So he wanted a ruling by, the rabbi in Poland, basically ensuring that the yeshivot would buy his edition and not Giustiniani's edition. There was also as I write about in my book, very interesting. Well, first of all, there was a familiar relation. The two of them were second cousins, so he might have been reasonably assured that he would get a favorable ruling from the Ramah. But they also, very interesting, shared intellectual kinship. They were both proponents of the kind of more rational philosophical approach of the Rambam. They shared a common intellectual framework, I would say.
So what was the Ramah's tshuva about? What did he say, and what was his reasoning and rationale behind it?
Right. Okay. So also very interesting. So, you know, he's faced with a case, let's say, this is a dispute, but of course, it's not a dispute before a court because Giustiani hasn't actually appeared before him. But he's faced with a case in which a non-Jew, right, has gone ahead and, you know, published this competing edition and has done so apparently with the intention of driving the Maram out of business, right? He, at the very least, Giustiani announces proudly, you know, I'm coming out with my edition and I'm going to sell it for one gold coin less than the Bagadini edition. He disparages the Maram's commentary. And he, you know, seems to have done it in partly out of spite. You know, this is not a traditional copyright case in the secular copyright sense, right? So the Maram's claim is not that Giustiani copied his expression, as we would see in a copyright infringement action today, right? Rather, it's that he came out with his competing edition of the same book. He did copy the Maram's own annotations, but that was pretty minor, right? That wasn't what it was at dispute here, right? The concern was that Giustiani, out of spite, wanted to harm the Maram's livelihood, to drive him out of business, is announcing he's going to undercut the price, and that's the harm, right? So the Ramah then is faced with the problem, you know, how can I say that a non-Jew has violated the halakha, right? What's going to be the legal basis for my ruling prohibiting this? And to do so, he looks at Noahide law, right? The body of Jewish law that imposes at least some basic fabric of obligations, even on non-Jews. And he has to interpret the Noahide law. One of the obligations on non-Jews in Noahide law is dinim, right? Non-Jews have to establish a system of court, some basic system of justice, right? Of course, non-Jews do not have to follow all of the halakha that applies to Jews. But rabbinic authorities, this is largely sort of, I would say, almost a philosophical approach, because typically Jews didn't have any authority over non-Jews to enforce Noahide laws of non-Jews, right? But it was at least a theoretical premise that, as the Rambam said, right, if a non-Jew abides by the Noahide laws, then there's a place for the non-Jew in the world to come, right? So it was basically a sense philosophically that there are some, you know, very basic, you know, don't kill and the like that apply to non-Jews. But the Ramah interpreted the obligation of dinim to mean that non-Jews have to abide by the same commercial practices, let's say, right, as Jews, at least in their dealings with Jews, right? So he said, once he decides that, and he says, well, right, if the Noahide obligation of dinim means that this non-Jew has to abide by Jewish commercial law, well, then I'm going to decide this case just as I would, as he colorfully puts it, we now can decide the case just as we would a dispute between two circumcised people. And then he proceeds to delve into the principle fundamentally of wrongful competition, right? Of hasag ha'gvul, right? And he says this is a quite clear case of this, where the Giustiani, the non-Jew, is deliberately undercutting the price of the Maram in spite to drive him out of business. And let me go back up. You know, another thing that makes the Ramah's ruling interesting is that the rabbis generally favored free competition, right? Especially when that would benefit consumers. And the Ramah, in his other rulings, is very much a proponent of free competition. And an example that I mentioned earlier about the alleyway, right, which is sort of the paradigm case of competition, in the Talmud, the rule is that the first to open up a shop in an alleyway cannot prevent the newcomer from competing in the alleyway, because competition, that's the majority rule, right? Competition is a good thing, right? As long as it benefits consumers, right? That's what the rabbis generally hold. But the Ramah found an exception to this in the work of the Avi Asaf, which is the Mavoi Satum, right? The closed alleyway. So under the paradigm case of the Mavoi Satum, if someone opens up a shop in a closed alleyway, right? There's only one entrance to the alleyway. And then someone else comes along and opens up their shop in the entrance of the alleyway, so that anyone who comes into the alleyway, all potential customers, have to pass the newcomer's shop on the way in. That's a different case, right? Because in that case, the newcomer is going to be able to siphon off all of the business from the incumbent, right, whose shop is deeper in the alley, and is going to severely harm that person's livelihood. So competition is great, that's the rule, but not necessarily where the first entrant's livelihood is going to be destroyed. And especially where the new entrant, in this case, Giustiani, is acting out of spite, right? Where he deliberately wants to drive the Maharam out of business. So that's the basic ruling. The Rama rules that Giustiani is violating the precept against Hazakat Gvul, and therefore he orders that no Jew in Poland shall buy a competing edition of the Mishneh Torah until the Maharam has sold out his edition.
I think it's worth mentioning also that the unfortunate aftermath of this was that it ended up dragging through the pontifical courts, and essentially the Talmud was burnt in 1553 in Italy, kind of because of this. So I don't know if you wanted to talk about that for a little.
So Giustiani was quite upset about this ruling. This is the time of the Counter-Reformation. The papal authorities were already beginning to crack down on Jewish printing, but this really lit the match. Giustiani's agents brought a claim before the papal authorities, arguing that the Maharam's version of the Mishneh Torah included anti-Christian statements in it. And ultimately, the 1553, the Pope issued a ruling that, all copies of the Talmud are to be burned. Many foundational Jewish books of the time were burned in cities throughout Italy, including the Mishneh Torah, right? So this really had a quite tragic aftermath.
Right, unfortunately. So obviously the book, I just want to point this out, obviously, but people should, there's a lot more in depth than we can get covered here in a short podcast. So if anybody wants, obviously check out the book, which I will include a link, but I'll talk about it at the end. So then the next chapter is about rabbinic reprinting bans take hold. So go through a little bit more on this. And then essentially the next one, from a Yiddish Bible to a German prayer book, which goes discusses the Mordechai Benet and the Chassam Sofer, Moshe Sofer, so tshuva between them. Then you have the next one is about the really about the Slavuta Gemara Talmud versus the Ram edition in Vilna, which became the standard. So that was a famous controversy there. Then chapter 8 is moving beyond reprinting bans from property to the law of the sovereign. So they discuss the Beis Shalom Nathanson, the Shalom Meshiv, and the Beis Yitzchak, Beis Chashmalka. So I don't know. There's a lot there. We're not going to be able to cover nearly all of that. But if there's anything over there exactly you think is relevant to mention here before we get to the last chapter, which we'll discuss a little bit in depth.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, so there were printing bans developed during this whole period, right? So, it's important, the rabbinic authorities and the Jewish communities, live in a situation of communal semi-autonomy and juridical autonomy. But they're constantly having to negotiate that with vis-a-vis the non-Jewish authorities and non-Jewish printers. And, they're constantly trying to provide vehicle to give an incentive for printing of foundational Jewish texts, which, of course, is at the heart of rabbinic life and rabbinic study. At the same time, they're having to negotiate the limits of their authority in many cases. I won't go into details, but there's a fascinating case of in Austria, Mordechai Benet, having to rule the Sefer Kavod, which was a holiday machzor, dispute over that. Initially, gave a reprinting ban for the Jewish publisher, but then is hauled into court basically by the Christian publisher of that same book and retracts his ban, right? So that's just one example of the difficulties that the rabbis faced in trying to develop and enforce Jewish copyright law. And then I want to briefly mention also the Shuelo Meshiv, right? So his ruling in 1860. So during that time, already there we see even in Central and Eastern Europe the development of modern copyright law, which basically recognizes copyright as a property right held by the author. And we have the decline, a substantial decline of the autonomy of Jewish communities. This is already the Enlightenment. The secular sovereigns no longer recognize the juridical autonomy of the rabbis. And therefore, it's increasingly difficult for the rabbis to enforce reprinting bans. And Shuelo Meshiv also followed, you mentioned the interesting battle between the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim, surrounding the Slavuta Talmud and the Vilna Talmud, the Ram Talmud. And he viewed this as highly destructive, right? And then basically they resulted in competing reprinting bans, right? So really interestingly, in 1860, in a case, the Shmuel Mashiv develops an entirely new theory of Jewish copyright law, right? Which is basically one based on property rights, right? He basically says that an author of a book has a perpetual property right, right, in his book. How do we know that? Well, as Yitzchak Shmelke said afterwards, with all due respect to the Shmuel Mashiv, there's no doctrinal basis for that, right? So basically, the Shmuel Mashiv says, well, our perfect Torah can't be any work, you know, has got to be better than the non-Jewish law. And the non-Jews recognize a property right for authors, so ours must also, right? He doesn't say that quite in so many words, but that's the basic gist of it, right? So we now have a number of competing conceptions of what is Jewish copyright law and what's its basis, right? We have the Shmuel Mashiv saying that it's a property right, and we have others saying, no, the right is grounded in rabbinic reprinting bans, in hasagat gvul, right, wrongful competition, custom, and the like, right? So there are competing understandings of, you know, of what's the halakhic basis for Jewish copyright law.
Right. And like you said, the other one is based on the Ramah, which we mentioned already before. So obviously, and I mention this again, just because the listeners really understand, the book really goes very, very in depth into each of these cases and each specific case and the reasoning behind it. So it's quite in depth. So everyone should, you know, check out the book. You will be able to see much more of this. Here we're just really skimming through it. So the last chapter, which I think is something that we really should mention here, as you know, discuss a little bit as we close out, is the present day debate. Is copyright infringement, quotation marks, stealing? And, you know, that really gets the title of the book, From Maimonides to Microsoft. And we didn't really mention this, is that, you know, is that just a catchy title? What's with the Microsoft case? And that's a case that happened in Bnei Brak with the Beis Din. And you mentioned that. And then the present day debate, you know, on copyright and Jewish copyright, you know, what does that mean? What are the two different main schools of thought? And just discuss all of that.
Yes. Well, first of all, let me just emphasize also, you asked about where the Microsoft comes from, but I do want to say something about where the Maimonides comes from also, right? The book is From Maimonides to Microsoft. Maimonides himself did not write about Jewish law of copyright. The Maimonides is taken from the Mishnah Torah, right? The case decided by the Ramah. Frankly, it was a catchy title, From Maimonides to Microsoft, the two M, so I use that, right? But I did not mean to imply in any way that Maimonides wrote about Jewish law of copyright. So the Microsoft in the 1990s, Israel had earned a dubious reputation as what people in software world would call a one-disc country, right? So software producers and record labels found that, you know, one copy of their work would be distributed in Israel and would immediately become the master copy for many people to make pirate copies and distribute them in the marketplace. So Microsoft decided to do something about this, and they began to bring lawsuits in Israeli secular courts, right, against this counterfeiting of their software. But they decided that that wasn't enough. You know, a lot of this counterfeiting was going on in Bnei Brak also, the Haredi city of Bnei Brak. So Microsoft also petitioned the esteemed rabbinic court in Bnei Brak for a rabbinic ruling that it is a violation of Jewish law to copy their software. And they got a ruling signed by seven rabbinic luminaries, including Yosef Shalom Eliashiv, Avadi Yosef and Nissim Karelitz. And that ruling, of course, as is the custom, was then plastered on Pashkvilim throughout the city of Bnei Brak. The rabbinic court's edict is quite short. I'll quickly just read through the significant portion of it. So they held, we hereby emphatically announce in the manner regarding those who commit the act of copying computer disks of programs of various texts and selling them for a low price. And I'm reading from translation, of course, right? And in so doing, wrongfully encroach upon the business of those who invested years of labor and significant sums of money developing those computer programs. Rabbinic authorities of the modern era have already expounded upon the prohibition of such wrongful competition at length, and every person who commits such act and copies any version is a transgressor. So the court issues this ruling. Anyway, I think it should be clear now that we've talked about the Ramah's ruling versus the Shmuel Mashiv's ruling. If the rabbinic court understood Microsoft's rights as one of a right against wrongful competition, right, against hasagat gvul, right? They even refer to Those who copy the computer programs and sell them at a low price, right? Sort of just like Giustiniani, right? Sold his book at a low price. So that is one interpretation and one ruling of Jewish law in modern day Israel. But there are also rabbinic authorities who follow the Shuelo Mashiv, right? Who argue that Jewish copyright is a property right and not just a right against wrongful competition, which has some significant ramifications, right? So the Microsoft ruling, it's not at all clear, for example, well, what if someone copied the computer disks and gave them away for free, right? As often happened, right? People were copying Microsoft software and just putting them, you know, counterfeit versions in the computer and then selling the computer, right? They were not selling them for low price. They were just giving them away for free. Or people that just made a copy for themselves for their own use. If you look at the literal language of the rabbinic court's edict, it's not clear that it covers that activity, especially if there's not proven economic harm to Microsoft from that. On the other hand, if Microsoft were to have a property right, it could prevent that copying. So there's an ongoing debate, right, in rabbinic authorities in Israel about what is the nature of the Jewish law of copyright.
Right, and you mentioned this and other things. I mean, I believe you mentioned there, I remember now it's not so relevant anymore with Spotify and Apple Music and those things, but it used to be when a number of years ago when you had the music coming out, people were just copying, burning the discs, and they were just copying it, like you mentioned. So I believe the music distributors, they were doing, they were leasing you the disc. It was just a lease of some sorts. It wasn't actually a sale.
Right. You're talking about in the Haredi world or in the Jewish world?
In the Jewish world where they would lease the CD for you on condition.
Yeah. So that was one theory. So some rabbis, issued rulings that are basically took the position that, as long as the creator hasn't actually handed over ownership, right, of that copy, just leasing the copy, then that person can exert control over the copy that otherwise would not be possible.
Right. Okay. So obviously, like I said, there's a lot more in the book. I'll add a link to it. I know the hardcover is quite expensive, but I will link to it in the show's notes. People can check it out. And Justin, finally, as you said, you are a law professor, a secular copyright scholar. Now that you wrote this, were you thinking of ever doing anything else on the field of Jewish law otherwise, or not as of now?
No, absolutely. I have an article that I'm working on purely on Hasakat Gul, right? Jewish law of wrongful competition. There was a fascinating case in New York several years ago involving two pizza restaurants, owned by Jews, and one brought the other before a rabbinic court to stop the competition. So a couple cases involving that there'll be an article, not a whole book, but I'm planning to write that up pretty soon.
Okay, sounds great. So with that, thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay, thank you.